What did you do during the pandemic? In the early days of COVID lockdown, many people found themselves taking up new hobbies like baking sourdough bread. But Peggy Orenstein went a little further. A lifelong knitter, Peggy decided to try making a sweater from scratch, and I mean really from scratch. She taught herself to shear sheep, spin and dye yarn, and other skills that contained surprising life lessons. Peggy is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, and she joins us now to share five big ideas from her new book, Unraveling: What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater.
Hi, this is Peggy Orenstein. I'm the author of the book, Unraveling: What I Learned While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. And here are a few of the things I learned. Start thinking about your clothing the way you think about your food. Breaking down a garment to its basic from-scratch components, learning to shear sheep and process fleece and spin and dye yarn, made me start asking why we don't think about our clothes the way we think about our food, in terms of ethics and sustainability, the impact on the planet or on the people who make our clothing for us. This was not something I'd thought a lot about before, and I didn't know about the decline in my lifetime of natural fabrics. Synthetics are in 70% of the clothing we wear. Nylon, polyester, viscose, rayon, dacron, acetate, lycra, spandex. And that's all just fancy language for petroleum-derived plastics. When I was a child, new clothing lines came out a few times a year. You got your school clothes, your summer clothes. That was it. But those synthetics, along with draconian labor practices, have made room for fast fashion outlets like H&M and Zara that produce hundreds of styles a week, and more recently, ultra-fast online stores like Shein and Boohoo that add thousands of new styles a day, each meant to be worn once or maybe twice, then tossed into landfill. Fashion is responsible for more greenhouse gases than international flights and maritime shipping combined, not to mention a fifth of global plastics and trillions of microfibers, tiny plastic threads shed by clothing when laundered that have become one of the biggest threats to the ocean. Honestly, part of me didn't want to know all this. After all, I was already recycling and composting and driving my Prius, and because I live in California, not flushing if it's only pee, and now, oh my God, my clothing? I just wanted to buy a pair of pants. Was enough to make me want to take to my eco-certified bed. But there are changes being proposed in the European Union to regulate the fashion industry, which is completely unregulated, and here we can support the Fashion Act in New York State or the Fabric Act in the U.S. Congress. Because if we want to address climate change, we absolutely have to address the fashion industry. Change is the only constant. But you knew that. Ancient colors rose and fell on color. Red was one of the foundations of the Spanish Empire. When they were off marauding and colonizing, they came across these bugs called cochineal in Central America. And if you squished the females, I don't know how they could tell they were female, you got this one drop of pure, durable, lightfast carmine, the most brilliant red that had ever been. It took hundreds of thousands of these bugs to dye a pound of cloth. They were worth more than their weight in gold. And the Spanish kept the source of this color secret for hundreds of years. Nobody knew it was insects. Color could be cutthroat back then. Blue was gaining popularity. Indigo was more easily imported to Europe, and that was affecting the profits of red. So the merchants of red would do things like bribe the makers of stained glass windows for churches to make devils blue, so that consumers would associate blue with hell and not buy it. And that didn't work. But then all of it collapsed in the 19th century when this college student, who's kind of like the Steve Jobs of his generation, was home for spring break trying to do an experiment that would impress his chemistry professor, and there was this pinkish-purple residue at the bottom of his test tube, and when he tried to wipe it out with a white cloth, he couldn't get the white cloth clean. It wouldn't wash out. He had invented chemical dye. The first one was the color mauve. And within 15 years, the natural dye industry collapsed. All that money, all that knowledge, all that history, gone. Dye made a fossil fuel, It has profound environmental implications, and dyeing and finishing textiles is responsible for a fifth of the world's industrial water pollution. But beyond that, it's fascinating to look at this moment in history. The invention of chemical dye was another of those nothing lasts forever moments when something that seemed so permanent, so eternal, just disappeared nearly overnight. In our time, the tech industry has bulldozed print newspaper, books, taxicabs, movie theaters, and maybe democracy. Meanwhile, there are the natural evolutions of life, children growing and leaving, parents dying, our own aging, fires and floods that alter landscapes, there are pandemics. It's another reminder that change is our only real constant, and our greatest skill is in our adaptability. Let go of, is it good? And does it suck? Through much of the book, I'm writing, ugh, I can't do this. I'm terrible at this. This isn't right. And then suddenly I go, oh, wait, this is the point. And I remember that there was a Linda Berry cartoon that I used to have up in my office where she wrote about how as a kid, she would draw in this beautiful freeform way, art just pouring out. And then at some point, she learned what she calls the two questions. Is this good? Or does this suck? And those are the death to creativity. Likely sometime in elementary school, you experienced some moment of what educational psychologist Ron Baghetto calls creative mortification, a phrase so evocative, I'll carry it to my grave. It's when you're shamed or just too harshly critiqued for your efforts, so you put down the pencil or the paintbrush or the baseball bat or the test tube or the violin or whatever it is, and you never do that thing that you loved. Again, mortification. It means literally to put to death. The best defense against those psychologically lethal blows is to resist good and bad altogether and instead ask questions like, what worked here? What might I do differently next time? It's recognizing that the gift of creativity is in the way that it challenges you, allows you to make meaning, enriches your life. So, I work in a creative field, and when you do that, commerce gets into it, sales, marketing, and that can erode some of your joy. I got that back by becoming an amateur for a little while and embracing that beginner's mind and remembering the importance of having some place in your life where you try to value process over product. Ancient women's work was always political. In ancient times, women spent an enormous amount of time spinning. That's how fairy tales started. They didn't have the internet or TV, so they would while away the time telling each other these stories, which used to be far more bawdy before the Grimms got a hold of them, and actually less gruesome, because the Grimms thought violence provided good moral instruction for children. Spinsters, by the way, those unmarried women who were free from the demands of children or a husband, they were valuable contributors because they could spend more time spinning. So it wasn't a bad thing to be a spinster. The Industrial Revolution took those tasks out of the home and, along with it, young women, teenage girls who, in reaction to the horrific conditions at the mills, launched the first labor strikes, which were unsuccessful in their lifetimes but formed the basis for the modern American labor movements and the modern American feminist movement. So, it's really no accident that years later, we have these young female voices like Greta Thunberg, X Gonzalez in Parkland, who's non-binary but grew up in a female body, or Malala Yousafzai. Teenage girls have always been our political voice, our conscience, our leaders. It's no accident that the first thing women did as an act of dissent when Trump was elected was knit. No matter how you feel about those pussy hats, there is a long, venerable history of using needlework as a political act. You probably learned about the Boston Tea Party in school, but did you learn about the importance of women's boycott of British cloth and their public spinning bees in sparking the revolution? Did you learn that in World War I, when over 75,000 troops had died of an epidemic of trench foot, which was caused by persistently wet toes, women on the home front saved the day, making socks by the millions? There are so many examples throughout history, both here and abroad. Today's public knitters have mobilized against nuclear proliferation and the decimation of coral reefs. They've made blankets to welcome refugees, crafted tiny sweaters to save oil spill damaged penguins, knit temperature scarves whose rows and colors document climate change, stitched for racial justice, sent handmade uteri to Congress in support of abortion rights. Do those acts of craftivism ultimately make a difference? Well, I believe that change starts with personal reflection, followed by connection to like-minded others, and finally, engagement in repeated, targeted collective action. The conversations our handwork inspires can jumpstart that process, one stitch at a time. Finally, sing with your elders. My mom had died when I started this book, and my dad had dementia. He was in a facility in Minneapolis, and I couldn't visit him during lockdown. It was hard to connect. He was hearing impaired, often non-responsive, and talking on the phone was nearly impossible. But while I was doing these ancient arts, I could slow down, especially when I was carding fleece, which you do with these two things that look kind of like dog brushes, and you put a little bit on the brush, and you go back and forth and back and forth to make it nice for spinning, and then you roll the whole thing up into a puff, and you put it aside. It would take me about 10 minutes to make a puff, and I read that you need 579 puffs for a sweater, so... But while I was doing that incredibly tedious work, I'd sit with my dad on the hyper-modern technology of FaceTime and just be with him. He thought we were together in the same room, and he'd say, "Peg, can you hand me a glass of water?" And I'd say, "Dad, I can't reach it. You'll have to get it yourself." And then we would sing, because that part of the brain is different than the part affected by dementia, and it's the last to go. So, "You Are My Sunshine," "Give My Regards to Broadway." My dad and I, we didn't always have an easy relationship. And he's gone now. He died in August. I am so deeply grateful for that last time we had together. I treasure it. It was one of the real gifts of the process that led to this book. Slowing down enough to have the time together, to just love him, and to make our peace. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the book.
Thank you, Peggy. That was Peggy Orenstein with 5 big ideas from Unraveling: What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.